trying to sound light.
Yep.
Kids?
No, he says. Not for me. I don't want any.
A million different things go through her mind. Would he have wanted to raise a baby a decade ago, assuming it was his? Or would he have fled the moment he knew she was pregnant?
Do you want to go for a drink?
He asks her. He still hasn't asked if she's married or has kids. Maybe he knows from his sisters, town gossip. Maybe he doesn't want to know. Maggie glances toward her parents' house, thinking about Roland holed up in the maid's quarters with her father. I'd better tell them, she says, not being specific. Back inside, she pounds on the door of her father's sanctuary. It opens a crack, and she's immediately engulfed in smoke. Her father thrusts his head out, looking put out. Maggie glimpses Roland sitting in the leather armchair, his legs extended in front of him, a cigar in one hand and a glass of Crown Royal in the other. Mario Lanza is on the radio. I'm going into town to meet Audrey for a drink, she tells them.
Shall I drive you?
Roland offers in a thick slur, ready to jump in the car and take her wherever she needs to go. He's a good man, she thinks guiltily. If only he hadn't changed. If only she'd met him first. You're in no shape to drive on the country roads, she says. We'll sleep here tonight. I'll tell Maman to make up Peter's old room for us.
Hard to believe it's been 10 years, eh?
Gabrielle says over a pitcher of lukewarm draft.
I like your hair like that.
He reaches out and touches it. Maggie sits very still as his fingers slide slowly down her natural waves. Then he pulls back and chugs some beer, as though the caress was a perfectly ordinary gesture.
So, do you have kids?
He asks her. Not yet. We're trying. I've had some setbacks. He nods, but doesn't offer any sympathy or encouragement the way most people do. She refills her glass.
What's your husband do? He asks.
He's a banker. Gabrielle lights a cigarette and exhales a straight line of smoke.
The seed man must be proud, he says. He's English, obviously.
Are you still angry with me?
Why would I be? He laughs. We were kids.
She doesn't believe him. Do you have a picture of Annie? She asks him. She's curious, like wanting to stare at an accident.
You know her name? He says.
Maggie blushes. Angèle mentioned it. She must be pretty. He shrugs. They finish off the pitcher and he orders another. She reaches for one of his cigarettes and he lights it for her with his Zippo. He flicks it shut with a swirl of his hand.
So, here we are, he says. Married to other people.
She opens her mouth to say something, but she's not sure how to streamline her feelings into a cohesive sentence. She looks into his eyes and is certain of one thing. She still wants him.
As soon as I saw you tonight, he says, you still look so good.
You sound disappointed.
I was hoping you'd gotten fat.
I wish it hadn't taken us 10 years to run into each other again, she says, suddenly overwhelmed by an urge to confess everything. Her pregnancy, the baby, the foundling home, even Yvonne. She's nearly drunk enough to do it, but in a moment of clarity, she decides to say nothing.
Now what? He says.
She shakes her head and they stare at each other for a long time, neither of them flinching or looking away. Maggie feels a spark of hope. For a quick moment, anything seems possible, but then a waitress comes by and Gabrielle gestures for the bill. Maggie's mood collapses. She takes another one of his cigarettes and leans in flirtatiously for a light. Are you happy? She asks him, holding his wrist to keep the flame steady.
What kind of question is that?
He says, leaving some cash on the table.
Let's go.
She follows him outside and they head toward Bruce Street. Without uttering a word, he reaches for her hand and holds it as they walk. It doesn't feel the least bit illicit. It feels natural and right. I wish we could just stay in this moment, she says as they approach the Small Brothers building.
Why can't we?
He says, pulling her into the alley. What are you doing? He pushes her up against the brick wall. Without warning, he kisses her. What shocks her most about it is not his presumptuousness or even her own recklessness in responding,
but her excitement. She's kissed him so many times before, yet it feels as exhilarating as that first time. He presses up against her, pinning her to the side of the building. Her arms instinctively go around his waist, one hand slipping under his shirt and sliding up his smooth back. But when his hand is suddenly under her skirt and traveling up her thigh, she pushes him away. Stop. He ignores her. Stop, she says again, her mouth against his ear. He looks at her, surprised. We can't do this, she says. Roland will be wondering where I am.
Roland,
Gabrielle mutters, his fingers slipping between her legs, tugging at her panties. Please don't, she says weakly. He stands back, glaring at her. This isn't how I want this to happen, she says.
How do you want it to happen? He asks angrily, adjusting his pants. We're married to other people.
Not cheating.
You'd like me to leave Annie so you feel better about fucking me?
Gabrielle, don't.
That's not an option, Maggie.
He swears under his breath and then impulsively punches the brick wall behind her head.
Same old Maggie, he says, shaking out his scraped hand. Leading me on, flirting. But when it comes right down to it, you don't really want to disrupt your privileged little life. You just want to know you can still get me. Go back to your goddamn banker.
I'd give anything for it to have all turned out differently, she cries, her voice reverberating in the narrow alley. And the truth, hurled out into the night like that, so stark and inexorable, stops him. They both stay there, not sure what to do next.
I'm sorry, he says. I'm drunk. This was a mistake.
The words land like knives. He walks her home, to the edge of the cornfield, the place they once hid together, made love and disappeared together, found and lost and found each other. She inhales deeply, not wanting to go inside. The air is humid and has that fragrance of high summer, a blend of dew, budding flowers, and fresh manure. The sky is starless. She realizes she's crying, but Gabrielle probably can't see her tears in the dark. Maybe this is for the best, she reasons. Lust is just a chokehold that renders the heart and mind completely powerless. At times, it has nearly destroyed her parents. She's better off with Roland, who is, or at least was, her friend.
Good night, Gabrielle says.
Without saying a word, she turns away from him and starts her climb up the hill.
Hey,
he calls after her.
I work the day shift at Canadair till 3:15.
Adair. Chapter 22. Maggie turns off the TV after Gunsmoke and goes upstairs to her bedroom. She removes her clothes, puts on her favorite white nightgown with the eyelet ruffle bib, and sits down on the edge of her bed to comb her hair. She gazes absently at the wallpaper, a red toile de jouy depicting French pastoral scenes, and realizes she's already sick of it. She still loves the room, though. It was one of the main reasons she wanted this house. It has a fireplace and coffered ceilings, and a breathtaking view of the backyard. She can hear Roland brushing his teeth, and she knows what will be expected of her tonight. He's going to emerge naked beneath his velour robe, and peel the bedspread back in a neat triangle, just enough for him to slide under without disturbing it too much. Then he'll lean across the bed and give her a minty, utilitarian kiss on the lips. She can practically smell the Colgate on his breath. Years of obligatory, anxiety-filled intercourse in an effort to procreate has accelerated the unraveling of their sex life.
Duplessis is dead.
What? She gasps, looking up to find Roland standing in the doorway of their ensuite bathroom.
I just heard it on the radio, he says,
his tone excited. Last night on CBC, it was reported that Duplessis had fallen ill after suffering a cerebral hemorrhage. Having never considered that a man as powerful as Duplessis might be vulnerable to such mortal inconveniences as illness or death, Maggie is genuinely shocked. My God, she says, overcome with some sense of vindication. She immediately runs downstairs to call her father.
The dictator is dead, he cheers.
It feels strange in a way, don't you think? He's been in the background of my life for as long as I can remember.
It took a brain hemorrhage to get him out of that office, but by God, Quebec is finally free. What if the next premier abandons agriculture?
Sweetheart, her father says. As this province soars, so too will superior seeds.
He's in a boisterous mood. Maggie can already picture him at work tomorrow, gloating and puffed up with satisfaction. She returns to the bedroom to find Roland tucked under the chenille bedspread, holding his transistor radio in his lap. He carries it around the house with him like a pet. Maggie goes directly into the bathroom to brush her teeth. When she's done, she stares at herself in the mirror for a long time, trying to see herself the way Gabrielle must have seen her the other night. Her face is rounder than she's used to, probably bloating from the last pregnancy. Or maybe cynicism and disappointment are already quietly undermining the beauty for which others have so often praised her. This may be what happened to her mother. Maggie remembers that photograph of Maman and the push lawnmower, how beautiful she was in her 20s, how different she is now. Maggie is slightly closer to 30 than 20. She shuts her eyes against the image of her future self, a clone of her mother with no discernible trace left of her youthful, lovely self, except for a single photograph, framed and sitting on a doily in her bedroom, for her future children to ruminate over and stare at in bafflement. She switches off the bathroom light and joins Roland in bed.
I still can't believe it, he says.
This date should be a provincial holiday from now on.
It's been a long time coming, Roland agrees,
and sets his radio down on the bedside table. Maggie snuggles up to him, resting her head on his chest.
What'll happen now? She wonders aloud. Only good things, I expect. Let's hope his replacement can move us forward into the 20th century.
It's truly the end of an era.
Your father must be elated, Roland says.
He'll probably throw a parade. They both laugh, and then Roland leans in to kiss her with all the awkwardness of a teenage boy making his first attempt. She gently pushes him away. Not yet, okay? He slumps back against his pillow and stares off in the distance, looking hurt.
I thought we were going to start trying, he says. The doctor said after the tubal washing, we should start immediately.
I'm just not ready, Roll. Roland sighs.
I understand, he says, softening. But soon, all right?
She kisses his chest and her body relaxes. Thank you, she says, relieved. The holidays come and go without much fanfare, followed by a long, deep winter hibernation, in which Maggie spends too much of her free time trapped indoors, thinking about Gabrielle and their dreamlike encounter in the field last fall. Curled up by the fire day after day, in the same wool sweater and thick ski socks, Maggie loses large chunks of time to her richly imagined fantasies. And then, one afternoon, shortly after winter is broken, Maggie finds herself in an unfamiliar part of the city. It's as though she's been holding her breath all these months, and now, suddenly, she can't hold it for another moment. It's a new decade. The 50s are over, and she feels restless, brazen from the cabin fever. She needs to breathe. Canadair is near the Cartierville Airport in Saint-Laurent. There's a bus that stops along Sherbrooke Street that will take her straight to Côte-Vertu. She walks purposefully, enjoying the mild March weather and the season's first strong rays of sun on her face. When she was a little girl, Canadair was well known for manufacturing airplanes during the war. A lot of the farm boys like Gabrielle used to travel to the city and work shifts all through the winter. She remembers Gabrielle bragging back in the late 40s, when Canadair began making F-86 Sabre jets, as though he himself were the one making them. He used to say that helping to build airplanes for the Royal Canadian Air Force was a privilege, even though he only made 43 cents an hour and worked 17-hour shifts. She's thinking about all of this as the bus comes to a stop at Côte-Vertu, and the full magnitude of what she's about to do presses down on her like the airplanes landing on the Cartierville tarmac. Chapter 23 Maggie traces the blue and white fleur-de-lis tattoo on Gabrielle's biceps with the tip of her finger. She imagines that making love with him now, as a woman, will be very different than it was when they were young. Their tender, tentative adolescent lovemaking, as well as the last few years of perfunctory sex with Roland, have taught her very little about sex, or even about how to be in her body. Sex with Gabrielle now, she fantasizes, will be more mature and free. But not yet. This time she's waiting, out of respect for Roland and a healthy fear of repeating past mistakes. She's told Gabrielle she won't sleep with him until they're sure they want to make a commitment. "When did you get this?" she asks him about the tattoo. They're at his friend's bachelor apartment on Papineau. There are beer bottles and ashtrays everywhere, mice scurrying boldly across the linoleum, and gusts of wind rattling the drafty windows. The friend who rents the place is never around. Maggie suspects he keeps it for sleeping with women who are not his wife. Gabrielle says it's nothing like that, but never elaborates.
"Couple of years ago," he says. "Do you know what the fleur-de-lis stands for?"
"It's on the Quebec flag."
"It was the first provincial flag in Canada," he says. "One of the few good things Duplessis accomplished."
"So you had it tattooed on you?"
"It's meaningful to me," he says. "It was from a banner that was carried by Montcalm's French-Canadian soldiers at the victory of Carillon."
He lights a cigarette and picks up an ashtray from the floor.
"You probably can't understand."
After a long silence, she says, "You still haven't really forgiven me, have you?"
"Forgiven you for what?" he asks.
"For ending it the way I did."
"We were teenagers."
"What if we'd stayed together?"
"It would never have worked then," he says dismissively.
"Maybe this would have been enough," she murmurs, snuggling closer to him.
"Meeting secretly in this dump?"
"Being together."
"You're too much of a romantic."
"Am I?" she says. "What is this to you, then?"
"I don't know. Me trying to have sex with you?"
She playfully punches his shoulder.
"And to you?"
he asks her. "I'm hoping it's a second chance for us," she admits. He runs his hand along her hair, and then lets it drop back to his lap.
"We're both married, Maggie. Is the future really an option for us anymore?"
"If it isn't, why are you here with me?"
"I told you, I want to sleep with you.
And if I don't?" Gabrielle sighs, exhaling at the same time.
"I honestly don't know," he tells her. "But I like being with you. It's easy. You know me."
"Doesn't your wife?" He shrugs.
"It's different. She knows part of me, the man I became when I moved here for good."
"And who is the Gabrielle I know?"
"The insecure boy who pulled a knife on a couple of thugs," he says. "The farmer's son. The kid who fell in love with an English girl who ended up breaking his heart."
She reaches out and touches his face.
"But you made the choice for us, Maggie, and it wasn't me."
She turns her head away, unable to look him in the eyes. It's on the tip of her tongue to blurt out that it was her parents who made the choice for her, her father. But then she'd have to tell Gabrielle about the baby, and she's not ready for that conversation.
"Anyway," he says, "it's the best life for you."
"What is?"
"His life, the one you're living."
"Who, Roland's?"
"Your father's."
"It's not that simple."
"He's always had you brainwashed, Maggie."
"My mother used to say the same thing."
"You couldn't have it all, I guess," he says,
his tone lighter.
"The big house, the banker, your old man's approval, and me."
"That's mean," she says, standing up to leave. He grabs her arm, pulls her back down on the couch, and straddles her. She can feel his erection, and it makes her weak.
"Do we have to talk so much?" he asks,
his breath warm against her neck.
"Let's just stop talking. It only causes problems."
He kisses her on the lips, and the hairs on her body stand up. She tickles his back under his flannel shirt, remembering that first time in the cornfield when he was just a boy. The sweat on his tanned skin, the way his ribs stuck out, the cocky way he would strut up and down those stalks. And now, here he is, with that same lean, strong back, and the same erratic temperament that never could manage to conceal his inner struggle between pride and vulnerability, between who he was and who he aspired to be. That's what he meant when he told her she was the only one who really knew him.
"Let's just enjoy this moment together," he whispers.
"You mean have sex?"
"Of course."
How can she enjoy their time together when her mind keeps leaping forward, strategizing and fantasizing, greedily wanting all of him? She dreads having to go home to Roland and his crusade to get her pregnant, to all the pretending and politeness, the smiling and fakeness. Gabrielle is real. She wants their relationship to be real. She has no interest in embarking on some kind of illicit affair, filled with secrecy and guilt and uncertainty. She can't stand the thought of him returning home to Annie tonight, sleeping beside her, talking intimately the way couples do. She wonders how often he makes love to Annie, and if he enjoys it. And it's killing her not to ask him. He kisses her neck, and she lets out a small cry. "What now?" she murmurs. But he doesn't answer.
Chapter 24 Elodie 1960 One day at lunch, someone tells Elodie matter-of-factly that Emmeline from the Saint-Sulpice orphanage is dead.
"You were there with her, weren't you?"
the girl asks, shoveling meat in her mouth.
"At Saint-Sulpice?"
"How did she die?" Elodie wants to know, her appetite vanishing.
"Overdose of Lagactyl, I heard."
Elodie is outraged. She's used to keeping her anger inside, despairing silently so as not to get in trouble. But this is more than she can tolerate. She'll never forget how Emmeline held her hand the night they arrived, the way she spoke up for all of them by telling Sister Ignatia they didn't belong here. Emmeline isn't the first one to die, and she certainly won't be the last. Elodie has a thicker skin about it now, or perhaps a harder heart. She's 10 now and takes things more in stride. Death waits in every corner of Saint-Nazarius, as real and ubiquitous as the nuns themselves. But never has it been this close to home. A few days later, when strange, itchy red spots appear all over her body, forcing Sister Ignatia to send her to the infectious disease ward on the third floor, Elodie seizes the opportunity to finally speak up on behalf of Emmeline and all the orphans.
"Chickenpox," the doctor confirms, taking a quick look at her neck and arms. "You mustn't scratch like that."
Elodie is studying him carefully, trying to assess whether he's one of them or someone who might be able to help her. He seems decent enough. His eyes are bright blue, and she likes the look of his mustache and the pocket square in his white coat.
"I'm going to give you a bottle of calamine lotion," he says. "Stop scratching, young lady. You'll have scars."
She almost bursts out laughing. Scars? If he could see the scars she's already got from all the beatings. He thinks she cares about chickenpox scars? He has no idea. He slathers her with pink lotion that feels cool on her skin and instantly soothing.
"You should cut your nails, too."
"Doctor?"
"Hmm?"
"A girl from the sixth floor died the other day."
"Yes,"
he says abstractly.
"This is an hospital. It happens."
"But there was nothing wrong with her."
"She wouldn't have been here if that was so."
"There's nothing wrong with me," Elodie informs him. "And I'm here. Most of us up there are perfectly normal. We're just orphans. We're not crazy."
"Your records say otherwise."
"What records?"
"When you were transferred here," he explains. "We have your records."
"What does mine say?"
"I'm not privy to the psychiatric ward's records," he says. "But I assure you, if you're here, there must be a reason."
"I'm normal," Elodie says adamantly.
"Stop scratching," he says.
"Can I see what's written about me?"
"Of course not."
"I don't want to die in here," she says. "They killed Emmeline, giving her too much Lagactyl. She came here with me from the Saint-Sulpice orphanage, and she was fine. She was smart and normal, and they gave her a lobotomy."
"It sounds like she was a very sick girl."
"But she wasn't, though. Not when we first got here. And now they've killed her."
"You're being very dramatic."
"She's not the only one," Elodie goes on. "Last year, another girl disappeared in the middle of the night. I heard her body was thrown out back and buried in the cemetery. All she ever did was sing."
Elodie remembers the little girl who used to sing herself to sleep every night, her sweet voice floating across the room. Her name was Agathe. She was only about 5, but Sister Ignatia used to beat her to try to get her to stop. One morning when Elodie woke up, someone said,
"Agathe's gone."
Her bed was empty, freshly made as though it had never been slept in. Nothing was ever said about what happened to her. No explanation was offered, as though they weren't worthy of knowing.
"They do all sorts of terrible things to us," she tells the doctor. "Can't you help us? Does anyone know what they're doing to us up there?"
"Calm down,"
the doctor says, frowning.
"Were the crazy patients in my ward crazy before they got here?"
"How would I know that?
Will I turn crazy if I stay here?
Where are you getting these ideas?
Please help me, she begs. We've been forgotten up there. And the nuns, they're cruel. They torture us. Please, isn't there something you can do?
The doctor places a hand on her knee.
I'll look into it, he tells her. Calm down, and I'll get to the bottom of it.
Elodie nods obediently, her whole body caving with relief.
Take this, he says, handing her the calamine lotion. And put it on when it gets too itchy.
Thank you, doctor.
He winks and she leaves the room, feeling lighter and happier than she has in years. She smiles at Sister Calvert, who's waiting for her by the door, and says, Chicken pox.
You seem awfully happy about it, Sister mutters,
and shuffles off down the hall, her habit swooshing with every step. Several days pass, and nothing happens. Elodie waits for the doctor to appear, expecting his visit. He promised he would look into it. Maybe the nuns are giving him a hard time, she reasons, and she has to be patient. Wouldn't it be something if he exposed the whole situation here, and the hospital realized there'd been a terrible mistake and set them free? Sent them back to Saint-Sulpice, where, to the best of Elodie's recollection, she'd been relatively happy? Lying alert on her cot one night, about a week after her visit to the doctor, she realizes that no one ever came by to give her her Largactyl. Maybe the doctors said something about Emmeline's death after all, and the daily tranquilizers have finally been outlawed. She has mixed feelings about not having her sleep medicine, but a surge of excitement at the possibility of freedom drowns out all other concerns. The next thing she knows, rough hands are shaking her awake. She tries to sit up, but someone pulls a pillowcase down over her head, making it difficult to breathe. There are hands grabbing at her, pulling her this way and that. The world is black under the pillowcase, but she can hear the buckles of the straitjacket as they attempt to get it on her. She thrashes, her screams muffled by the fabric, terrified she's going to suffocate.
Calme-toi, one of them hisses,
and she immediately recognizes Sister Ignatia's voice. They're wrestling with her now, but she's making it very difficult for them to fasten the buckles.
Stay still!
Sister Ignatia says impatiently, and then punches her in the head. Elodie's body goes limp. The straitjacket is tightened. Sister Ignatia is barking orders. Elodie realizes the other assailants are patients just like her, willing to comply, relieved it's not them. They carry her in total blackness to another room, where she's dumped on her back on a metal bed frame, and then tied to it like an animal. There's no mattress, and she can feel the sharp metal coils digging into her back where the straitjacket doesn't cover her body. The pillowcase comes off her head, and Elodie realizes, to her great horror, that she's in a dark, airless cell with boarded-up windows. The heat is stifling.
What have I done?
She cries, pleading with Sister Ignatia.
Why are you doing this to me?
Sister Ignatia does not answer. And her silence is more frightening than anything she could have said.
Please don't leave me here, Elodie wails. Please, sister.
Sister Ignatia slides a bucket under the bed, and Elodie understands immediately that she's going to be here for a while, that she won't be untied, even to go to the bathroom.
Don't leave, she pleads. It's so odd, please.
Sister Ignatia turns sharply, the skirt of her habit swishing at her feet, and marches out of the cell with her lackeys trailing mutely behind. Elodie contemplates screaming out, but quickly discards the idea. She knows no one will hear her, and if they did, no one would come. She squirms around on the cot, trying desperately to find some shred of comfort, a slightly bearable position at least. But it's impossible with the straitjacket and the heat and the metal digging into her flesh. Sleep doesn't come either. Without a mattress or air circulation or the ability to move her limbs, she can only lie there, berating herself for not having tried to escape a long time ago. Could she have? Not at 7 years old. Not once she was locked behind the doors of Ward B. Agathe escaped. Emmeline escaped. Perhaps death is the only viable way out. She decides she will never again grieve the death of another Saint-Nazarius girl. Why should she? They're free. They're at peace, and she, Elodie, is the one left in hell. She measures time by the meals they bring her three times a day, a puree of whatever was served in the cafeteria. The cell reeks of urine and feces and her own vomit.
Once in a while, out of intolerable boredom, she prays. She bargains with God, questions how he can allow her to be treated this way. But no answer ever comes, only more of his callous silence, a void where there is supposed to be solace. She hates him almost as much as she hates Sister Ignatia. After nearly a week of imprisonment, exactly 17 vile milkshakes, the door opens and Sister Ignatia appears, her expression smug. She unlocks Elodie's chains and wordlessly unfastens the straitjacket. Elodie winces the moment her arms are free. Her muscles are stiff, her joints ache, and her bones are weak. Every inch of her body hurts. When she tries to sit up, she lets out a cry and collapses. The sharp metal in her back was preferable to the pain of trying to move. Sister Ignatia hands her a dress, wincing at the stench from the overflowing bucket, and then covers her mouth and nose with her hand.
"Is it because I told the doctor about Emmeline's overdose?"
Elodie wants to know. A flash of something gleeful, victory or amusement, passes over Sister Ignatia's bat-like eyes. But she doesn't give Elodie the satisfaction of a response. Chapter 25 Maggie. Maggie wakes up from a terrifying nightmare, crying out so loudly she wakes Roland. She leans over and turns on the lamp with trembling fingers. Her heart is racing.
"What's the matter, dear?"
he says, placing his hand on her shoulder.
"I dreamed I was drowning," she says, trying to calm down. "I was pregnant, and we were both drowning, the baby and I. I kept thinking I can't lose this one, too. Oh, Roland, it was awful."
She doesn't mention that the unborn baby's name in her dream was Elodie. Roland pulls her close and they lie back together, leaving the lamp on at her insistence. The next day, having barely recovered from her sleepless night, Maggie sits down in one of the booths at Fern's and orders a cup of coffee while she waits for Audrey. Maggie's got a driver's license now and a Ford Falcon that Roland bought her for her birthday. Now that she's finally quit Simpsons, she has even more free time on her hands, mostly to ruminate over the two lives she finds herself caught between, which is no doubt to blame for her recent nightmares. One of those lives contains her beloved homes, her treasured garden in the country, and her marriage to a wonderful man she can never quite love enough. The other, still mostly a fantasy, contains Gabrielle, which she believes is enough. She hasn't stopped thinking about him since their encounter at the apartment on Papineau. She's been telling herself a lot of things lately to justify her emotional infidelity, but the one that seems to assuage her most is that she should have been with Gabrielle all along. She's only just found him again, but her feelings are as deep and unyielding as they always were. Roland doesn't ask much of her. He works long hours and is generally happy when she's happy. His trust and complacency, or unwillingness to scratch beneath the surface of things, makes falling in love with another man almost too easy. She lights a cigarette, still thinking about how things left off with Gabrielle when she went to the apartment the other day.
"Say hi to Audrey for me," he said as she was leaving.
His tone had an edge to it. She'd made the mistake of letting him know she was getting together with Audrey and Dunham. Of course, it brought back that incident long ago, with Barney and the fight in the street when Gabrielle pulled a knife. He didn't have to say it, but he was angry. She could see it in his face at the mention of Audrey's name. Maggie regretted it immediately. They didn't speak while she collected her things. A familiar tension had wedged itself between them, and she worried fleetingly that maybe love could not surmount one's roots. She wants to believe love is irrepressible. But what if it can't hold its own against who a person is, fundamentally at the core? It terrifies her that they would have to give up on each other after all this time and retreat to their respective sides, defeated by the complexities of language and class.
"Can I see you again Friday?"
he asked her. "I can't," she said. "Roland likes to see a show on Friday nights."
"Qu'il mange de la merde,"
Gabrielle muttered. "Let him eat shit." She kissed him and touched his face. His eyes were dark gray, angry. "Another day," she said. "Any day but Friday. I want to see you again." He looked away. She made him promise to call her. That's how they parted. She glances up from her cup of coffee and sees Audrey waddling toward her. Audrey is 7 months pregnant with her third child, rosy-cheeked from being outside, and more adorable than ever. Her blonde hair is bleached platinum now, like a movie star's. They've continued to stay in touch over the years, politely and from a distance, just enough to still be able to count each other as an acquaintance. Audrey likes to send Christmas cards with photographs of her family, accompanied by long, self-indulgent letters detailing their achievements with exclamation points. Barney was promoted. Lolly is finally potty trained. Davy won the Goutte de Lait Healthy Baby Contest. She also likes to get together once or twice a year for pie and coffee, so she can brag in person. How are you feeling? Maggie asks her. Not so bad, Audrey says, sliding her unwieldy body into the booth. You look gorgeous. You've still got that figure. I envy you. Maggie smiles, but she can tell Audrey does not envy her at all. Audrey orders a coffee and some apple pie, and takes a drag off Maggie's cigarette. Where do we begin? She says, clapping her hands together. How are the kids? Lolly is a hoot, and Davy is an absolute monster. I'm crazy to be having another one. I don't know what I'll do if it's another boy. Listen, she says. Before we get into things, how are you coping, Mags? Maggie tips her head. Coping? I hear you're having a hell of a time getting pregnant, Audrey says, her voice turning sympathetic. She lowers her voice and whispers, the miscarriages. Maggie flicks her ashes into the ashtray. Where did you hear that? She asks. Oh, you know Dunham, she says. Violet, I think. I've had a tubal washing, Maggie tells her. The prognosis is good. Audrey is obviously rooting for Maggie to get on the baby bandwagon. People seem to have so much invested in a married woman getting pregnant within the accepted timeline. It troubles them when it doesn't happen, as though some universally agreed-upon contract has been tampered with or disturbed. Maggie can actually feel the unspoken championing of her success at fertility, the simultaneous panic if she were to fail. The waitress brings Audrey's pie. Do you think... What? Never mind, Audrey says. Forget it. She has a bite of her pie. What? Well, I wonder, do you think, is it possible there was some damage from the, first pregnancy? Yes, that's exactly what the doctor said. There was scar tissue after the first miscarriage. No, Maggie, she interrupts. That's not the pregnancy I mean. Maggie freezes. Audrey is rubbing her belly protectively, watching Maggie. What are you talking about? Maggie manages, her chest pounding. Oh, it's all right, Maggie. I've always known. Maggie stubs out her cigarette and lights another one. Her fingers are shaking. Audrey reaches across the table and touches her hand. It doesn't have to be a secret anymore, she says. How did you find out? Maggie asks, trying to keep her voice calm and contain the waves of shame rising up in her throat. Audrey gobbles another forkful of pie and burps. I've got the worst indigestion, she says. To be honest, I always suspected. How? I know what Gabrielle expected, she says. I wouldn't go all the way with him, which is probably why he traded me in for you. The remark stings, and Maggie glares at her. How did you know I was pregnant? There's a reason girls get sent away for a year, Audrey says. And, well, now you've confirmed it. Their eyes lock. Maggie is suddenly confused about why Audrey wanted to meet with her today. Perhaps Audrey's been biding her time for years, waiting for just the right moment to pay Maggie back for stealing Gabrielle. I wasn't pregnant when they sent me away. Audrey's blue eyes widen. You weren't? No. My parents sent me away to keep us apart, just like I told everyone. It was all true. And then he came to see you there. He got you pregnant while you were there? She leans back in the booth, looking very satisfied. Don't be mad at me for bringing it up. I'm just curious. Maggie is quiet as she tries to guess at Audrey's motives. Maybe she's just trying to be a friend. Before Gabrielle, they'd been inseparable. I just want you to know that I'm here if you need someone to talk to, she says, burping into her napkin. I know we grew apart when I started dating Barney,
but I've always missed our friendship. I know you're going through a hard time right now. I wanted to reach out.
Does anyone else know? Maggie asks her.
Not that I know of, Audrey says.
Does Gabrielle know?
No, Maggie says. Not yet. And please, no one else should know. I'll tell him when the time is right.
It's been 10 years.
I hadn't seen him until recently. So you're in touch with him again? Maggie swallows nervously, wishing she could backtrack.
We ran into each other, she says vaguely. We were both home visiting. I am going to tell him. Soon.
Audrey nods, smiling sympathetically.
What was it like? She asks. Being pregnant and knowing you were giving up the baby.
I don't really remember, Maggie lies. I always feel so bonded with my babies when I'm carrying them.
I guess I liked the feeling of her inside me.
Her?
Maggie nods.
A girl?
Audrey gasps, as though knowing the sex makes it all the more tragic. Will you try to find her one day?
Giving information to the birth mother is illegal, Maggie explains. So it won't be easy, but yes, I'm going to try. I've already called the foundling home where she was supposedly taken.
Audrey raises her perfectly plucked and penciled brow. Do you think about her a lot?
Every single day of my life, Maggie confides, grateful to finally say it out loud. I think if it wasn't for what I did, giving away my own child, sending her out into the world alone, things would be all right. I just find it, well, it's impossible to ever feel completely okay knowing she's out there. The guilt's been so much worse since the pregnancies and miscarriages.
That makes sense.
Maybe I don't deserve to be happy, or to have another child.
Rubbish, Audrey said. How's Roland handling this?
He works a lot.
They always do.
But he's a good husband for you. The remark reminds Maggie of her days at Simpson's. She'd point out the sturdy clasp and the thick, supportive straps.
This is a good brassiere for you, she'd tell the customers. He's a good husband for you.
Listen, the other thing I wanted to tell you, Audrey says, brightening, is I've got a job for you. My uncle's a journalist at the Gazette, and he mentioned he knows a French-Canadian writer who just had a book published. He needs a translator for the English version. I told him I know someone who could do it.
I've never translated anything before. How hard can it be? Audrey says.
You're perfect for it. You're bilingual. I don't know anybody as good in both languages as you are. And you were always so good at composition.
I could never. It would be published, Maggie.
Maggie's heart lurches just thinking about it.
I'm unqualified.
Just meet him, Audrey says. His name is Yves Godbout. What have you got to lose?
Maggie's interest is definitely piqued. Perhaps it's an opportunity to do something useful for a change.
All right, I'll meet him, she says, feeling brazen.
Oh, good, Audrey says, reaching for her hand.
Maggie smiles appreciatively, thinking she's underestimated Audrey all these years.
Chapter 26. Yves Godbout is waiting for her at the St. Regis Brasserie downtown. He's sitting at one of the long wooden tables with a pitcher and two glasses, a pack of tobacco and rolling papers spread out in front of him. The tavern is long and narrow, a man's place, with wood floors and wood paneling on the walls. Even rows of picnic-style tables lined up like a mess hall. There's a loud clang and clatter of dishes from the kitchen behind them. Godbout looks to be in his late 30s. The roots of his brown hair are greasy, and even though it's warm outside, he's wearing a ratty gray sweater with holes in the elbows. He nods as Maggie approaches, but he doesn't stand up to greet her.
I'm told you're half French, he says, not wasting time.
My mother's French. His eyes narrow. He lights his homemade cigarette, and the smoke that floats into her face makes her gag.
From where?
He asks.
Hochelaga. Mine too, he says, warming slightly. My mother still lives in the same tar paper shack where I grew up.
Maggie isn't sure what's expected of her. Does he want her to commiserate?
I don't have any credentials, she tells him.
Credentials?
He laughs.
You think I have a degree in creative writing?
How long is your book? she asks him, trying to sound professional. Before he even finishes his cigarette, he licks the edge of his rolling paper and seals a fresh one without answering her.
About 50,000 words, he responds. The publisher pays 3 cents a word.
She does a quick calculation. The money isn't much of an enticement.
So you married an Anglo, Gudbus says. Larson.
Yes.
Why?
Because he asked me. His eyes dart down to her pearl necklace, and then back up to her face.
You know, not so long ago a small English press wouldn't have considered publishing a book like this,
he says, reaching under the table and pulling out a copy of his book. He holds it against his chest, over his heart.
But things are already beginning to change,
he tells her.
With Duplessis dead, there's going to be a revolution in this province. My publisher, he knows this. For an English guy, he's pretty smart. He has vision. Anglos have never wanted to read anything by a Quebecois writer, unless it was Gabriel Roy.
He hands her the book. It's called On va en venir à bout. Is there a deadline? She asks.
Hopefully before I'm dead. I think my publisher wants it done as soon as possible, to capitalize on the fervor around Duplessis' death. Things will move quickly now.
50,000 words.
You don't get any sign credits, he tells her. Which means your name won't be on the cover of the book, only on the copyright page.
She looks down at the cover and instantly knows what it will be called in English. We shall overcome. I'll read it, she says.
I'll have the publisher call you.
They shake hands, and Maggie leaves the tavern feeling terrified and inexplicably excited. Less than an hour later, she's standing outside Canadair, where the men are starting to pour out after the day shift. She can't wait to tell Gabrielle about her meeting with Godbout. They've spoken a couple of times over the phone, but haven't seen each other again. She spots him in the crowd, and his face instantly brightens when he sees her. She breaks into a smile. Will it always feel this way with him? Exhilarating, wicked, slightly terrifying. He takes her in his arms, smelling of airplane grease, not caring who sees them. His reluctance to get attached to her seems to have fallen away as swiftly and completely as the decade of their separation. Their landslide into the old feelings of their youth has taken them both by surprise, but at the same time, feels absolutely right and inevitable. They've acknowledged to each other in giddy whispers over the phone that not being together has become utterly inconceivable.
What are you so excited about?
He asks her, taking her by the hand. I'm going to translate a French book called On va en venir à bout. Gabriel stops suddenly and faces her, his eyes bright.
You're translating Yves Godbout's book?
You know him?
I know of him. I've read the book.
You met him? Yes, I just met with him.
What's he like?
Well, he's got brown teeth and yellow fingers and greasy hair and torn clothes. And he was extremely condescending. But besides all that, he's wonderful. Gabrielle laughs.
Maggie, this is incredible. How did it happen?
Audrey set it up, she says.
Audrey did,
he says, sounding shocked.
Can you do it justice?
I'm not sure, she admits. I've never formally translated anything.
I don't mean it like that. I mean, can you convey his passion for the cause?
I hope so.
I can help you, he says.
Really? I'd love that. Gabrielle pulls her into his arms.
This is good for you, he tells her.
And for us.
Let's get started as soon as I'm back, he says. And I want to meet Godbout.
No mention of the husband and wife who still stand in their way. They continue on arm in arm toward his car. I'm excited, she says, more to herself.
Me too.
I want to be with you, she tells him, her readiness for it sharpening into focus, even as the words form on her tongue. I want us to finally start our life together.
I want that too.
You do? Really?
Of course. It's you I'm worried about, he says.
But you're the one I want to be with.
What about everything you'd have to give up? He reminds her.
I'm miserable in that big house with all my beautiful things. Roland is a good man, but our marriage isn't what I hoped it would be. He pulls a pack of cigarettes out of his shirt pocket, offers her one, lights both of them. They exhale at the same time. Are you ready to leave Annie? She asks him.
I've been ready to leave Annie since the night I ran into you in the field.
All right then, she says. Let's tell them.
Let's just sit with it a while longer, okay?
More thinking? We just agreed.
We're deciding about our future, Maggie. We're talking about divorce.
He opens the car door for her.
You'd be giving up a lot.
I told you I don't care about any of that stuff.
I just want you to be absolutely sure, he says, pulling onto the street. I don't want you to resent me because I can't provide for you the way you're used to. I never want that burden. We're going to move very slowly, okay?
Maggie nods, taking her cue from him. Impulsiveness has only ever gotten her into trouble. For the first time, she feels confident and clear about what she wants, and impervious to defeat. When they get to the apartment, Gabrielle orders Saint-Hubert barbecue, and they have a picnic on the floor. Chicken and gravy and red wine. Maggie is euphoric. This is the best day, she says, touching his face. I love you.
I love you too.
She climbs over the containers of food and kisses him on the mouth. He pulls her into his arms and lies down on his back, her body on top of his. The moment has no feeling of illicitness or duplicity. Knowing they're going to be together, it feels absolutely perfect. He lifts her shirt over her head, and she does the same for him. He unclasps her bra, and it slips onto the wood floor. The moment he lifts his head toward her breast, and the tip of his tongue grazes her nipple, she cries out, and there's no turning back. Chapter 27 Roland reaches for the pitcher of lemonade and refills his glass. His forehead is glistening with sweat, and his cheeks are flushed. Maggie leans across the table and pats him with her paper napkin.
It's muggy for May, he says,
aggressively spraying off into a swarm of mosquitoes until she can taste it with every bite of her hamburger. He starts folding and refolding his napkin.
It's been a long time since...
He looks up at her nervously.
Since we discussed our situation.
She doesn't say anything.
You're still not pregnant, he says. I'm starting to get concerned. Maybe our timing's been off, but still.
She hasn't told him she's been using her diaphragm. She hides it in her underwear drawer under her many top salesperson brassieres.
I think we should see Dr. Surrey again, he says. He was very optimistic. He might have a tip for us.
The pine trees bordering their land begin to close in on her. The sun is disappearing, bringing more mosquitoes. Roland, are you happy? She asks him.
About what?
In general, with us, our life.
Yes, of course, he says. Obviously, it hasn't been smooth sailing, but I think the best remedy is to start a family. A child will be just the thing.
Gazing out at her expansive backyard with the geraniums blooming in clay pots and the manicured lawn ready for a swing set and sandbox, she can't find the words to tell him the truth.
Is there any jello left from last night? He asks her.
Do you really think a child can fix this?
This?
I'll get the jello, she says, dropping it, escaping inside to regroup. She returns moments later with a glass dish of green jello.
Lime, my favorite, he says, smiling appreciatively.
I don't think that I can do this anymore, she tries again.
Do what?
Be in this marriage.
I beg your pardon?
I'm sorry, Rawl, it's just not working.
You're telling me this now? He says, incredulous. Like this?
I'm sorry. I didn't know how else... Roland looks confused. His eyes go a bit out of focus. He stabs his spoon into the jello and breaks it up into pieces.
It's obvious your fertility problem is causing you great stress, he says. I wish you would quit being so stubborn and let me make us an appointment with Dr. Surrey.
It's not about my fertility problem.
We'll regain our footing as soon as we start a family, he says confidently. Let's make an appointment next week.
Don't you see what's happening to us, Rawl? Everything's become about having a baby. There's nothing else.
That's not true, he defends. It's not all about that.
It is for you.
Of course I want to start a family, he admits. I want to be a father. I'm not going to apologize for that.
You shouldn't have to, she says. It's just not the end-all for me. She feels herself getting emotional and wipes her eyes with a paper napkin. I've been convincing myself that I'm ready to have a child.
You're saying you're not.
You know I loved working, she says. You pretended to support my independence at first, but it turns out you weren't being sincere.
I wasn't pretending, he cries. I just didn't realize it precluded having children.
It didn't. It doesn't. It's more like our difficulty trying to have a child has exposed the bigger problem.
Which is?
Isn't it obvious, Rawl?
Not to me.
There's no passion between us, she says. Maybe there never was. I'm not even sure we want the same things anymore.
Roland looks away, hiding his face. This would all just go away if we had a child, he murmurs obstinately. The passion would come back. Our goals for the future would realign.
Would they? She says. You don't even know mine.
Tell me then.
Well, for one thing, I love translating. Roland lets out an exasperated huff. I've been trying so hard to be the person you want me to be, she says. Trying to give you a baby, ignoring how much pressure it's put on me, pretending not to notice that it's slowly killing our respect for each other and whatever attraction may still be there. I want more, Roland. My work with Godbu has helped me get in touch with that part of myself again. Roland sighs and his shoulders collapse. He looks tired,